Okay, good morning, everybody. Welcome to Bio 241. And this is your last lecture on nervous system. And don't forget, next time is a lecture exam. All right, and you have the whole period until 1 o'clock or 10 minutes to 1 to take the test. I don't know if there's 100 questions on the test. There might be 100 questions on this one. More the better, right? Because if you miss one, it doesn't count so much against you. And you need a picture ID. I'll try to send you out an email. You need a good Scantron, nice clean Scantron, an 882, right? Here's a really nice example. Oh, those aren't examples. Close. Ah, there's a good example. Thank you so much. Yeah. 882 without the bubbles filled in. Those are the best ones to get. Nice and clean. And but some come with shading, okay? I don't mean that you would pencil them in before the test, but some come with shading, and it does confuse the Scantron reader if it does have the green shading in the bubble. So get the ones that have a nice white background. And I don't know if you need a calculator or not. I can't remember. So bring your calculator and your picture ID, pencil, eraser, and then you're good to go. All right, so does anybody have any questions over nervous system? So far, so good. Okay, we were talking about a synapse last time. And synapses require ligand-gated channels to create a change in membrane potential on the postsynaptic cell. So here is just an overview of a neuron. All right, so we see dendrites and cell body and then an axon. And the cell body is the integration area of the neuron because it contains ligand-gated channels. And it also has chemical synapses. There might be as many as 10,000 chemical synapses on dendrites in a cell body. So it's receiving information from many, many neurons, thousands of different neurons. And these synapses could be excitatory or they can be inhibitory. And each chemically gated, or each chemical synapse right here is going to produce a gated potential, which means that the inhibitory signals and excitatory signals can be added together, right? That's why we call this integration. So inhibitory signals will subtract from excitatory signals. So every neuron acts as an integration center. Graded potentials then flow down to the axon hillock. And as they flow down to the axon hillock, what happens to a graded potential? It dies away, right? They slowly die away in intensity. And in the axon hillock right here, if all those IPSPs and EPSPs add together to produce a threshold voltage, what happens here at the axon hillock? An action potential. So action potentials can't flow over dendrites and cell body, and you should probably know why an action potential is never propagated over dendrites and the cell body. Why is that? Because it's missing a particular channel, which is a voltage-gated channel. All right, so the channels, the gated channels on dendrites and cell bodies right here are ligand-gated channels. That means that a neurotransmitter can cause these membrane potential changes, but not a voltage-gated channel. Voltage-gated channels are what we find in axons. And that's what produces action potential, voltage-gated channels. So in this region right here on your diagram, kind of maybe like the hand-drawn illustration of a neuron that's in your study guide. All right, you want to say impulse conduction over here because you have voltage-gated channels. You have integration in this part of the neuron because you have ligand-gated channels. And integration is a result of graded potentials being produced by ligand-gated channels. Impulse conduction happens due to voltage-gated channels, and that's what we call an action potential. All right, and then when action potentials reach the axon terminus down over here, that's going to cause release of neurotransmitter. As the frequency of action potentials increases at this axon terminus right here, then there will be more neurotransmitter released. All right, so the frequency of action potentials is directly related to the amount of neurotransmitter that's released from this axon terminus. All right, so let's look at the overall scheme of synaptic transmission. You have action potentials moving down an axon to the axon terminus or the bouton terminale or the terminal buttons or whatever you want to call those little swellings at the end of an axon. And there are voltage-gated calcium channels in the axon terminus. All right, so When an action potential reaches the axon terminus, you have calcium entering the cell. That calcium is a nice signal for the movement of synaptic vesicles over to the presynaptic membrane, because we're talking about the presynaptic neuron right here. And that's going to exocytose neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. All right, neurotransmitter moves across the synaptic cleft, and neurotransmitter is a chemical signal, and it can bind to something on the postsynaptic neuron. What could it possibly bind to? A receptor, for instance. Okay, and when the ligand binds to receptor, that's going to open some ligand-gated channels, and there can be a couple different kinds of ligand-gated channels. For instance, if the neurotransmitter binds to a gated channel that's a sodium channel, you have sodium entering the cell, which is going to cause depolarization or excitation. That's going to produce an EPSP. All right. If neurotransmitter binds to a potassium channel and opens up a potassium channel, that's going to cause hyperpolarization, right, which is an IPSP, will inhibit the cell. Or if it binds to a chloride channel, so chloride can enter. Remember, chloride is an anion. When chloride enters the cell, that's going to cause hyperpolarization as well, which is going to produce an IPSP. Okay, these IPSPs and EPSPs will flow together over the cell. They can add or subtract from each other depending on the nature of the signal. So by the time the graded potential reaches the axon hillock, then all of that information from all those different synapses will be added up. And if the membrane potential reaches threshold at the axon hillock, then that's going to cause an action potential which will flow all the way down from the axon hillock to the axon terminus. And if it's below threshold, then an action potential won't be transmitted down an axon. Okay, so this is a pretty nice synopsis of synaptic transmission. And what you should definitely realize is how important calcium is, right? Calcium ions in the extracellular space for synaptic transmission. Before taking anatomy and physiology classes, you probably knew calcium is important in your body. For what particular reason? It's making bones strong. And none of us want to have brittle bones that break. But calcium is also important for synaptic transmission, for communication within the nervous system, and even communication from a nerve to a muscle. And indeed, you probably would sacrifice your bones to have proper synaptic transmission. And indeed, that's what your body decides to do too. As we get older and we don't have proper calcium in our diet, or if we don't exercise properly, or if we don't have proper vitamin D in our diet, okay, our body goes to bones to get calcium, right, so that neurons can communicate with other cells. One particular kind of neurotransmitter, which is very important, is called acetylcholine. It's the most widely used neurotransmitter. It's used in the brain and autonomic nervous system, and it's used at all neuromuscular junctions. And in particular, the neuromuscular junction is for skeletal muscle, right? So acetylcholine is important for all voluntary or somatic motor neurons in your body. And so it's a very important kind of neurotransmitter. It can have different effects in different parts of your body. Sometimes it's excitatory. It's excitatory at all neuromuscular junctions, 100% of the time. When an action potential reaches the axon terminus of a somatic motor neuron, it will always cause an action potential in a skeletal muscle fiber, which will be always excitatory and will cause that skeletal muscle fiber to contract. But that might not be the case in the autonomic nervous system. Sometimes acetylcholine is inhibitory on some organs, and a good example of that would be the heart, for instance. When we place acetylcholine on the heart, it slows the heart rate down. All right, so how is it that a particular neurotransmitter can be excitatory in one part of your body, but inhibitory in a different region of your body? That's a pretty reasonable question to ask. Right? If it's the same neurotransmitter, how come it can have opposite reactions in different organs? And that's because, does anybody have a thought on why possibly that could be? Exact same molecule. Okay, because different organs might have different kinds of receptors. All right, so nicotinic receptors are always excitatory, but muscarinic receptors, okay, sometimes are excitatory, sometimes are inhibitory. All right, and we're going to take a look and see why that is possible. All right, and so if a receptor is going to bind acetylcholine, then it's a ligand-gated channel. Right? So a ligand-gated channel has both a receptor site, an active site for binding the neurotransmitter, which would be acetylcholine in this particular case. How do you think about the relationship of the receptor site on a ligand-gated channel and the neurotransmitter? How does this neurotransmitter know to bind to that active site on a ligand-gated channel? It's based on the shape of the molecules, right? They have to be complementary in shape. Use that lock and key model to understand how a ligand will bind to a receptor site. Okay, and when that ligand binds to a channel, it will open that channel. And if it's a sodium channel, what will be produced? Excitation or depolarization. Okay, but if it's a potassium channel, what's going to happen? It's going to inhibit the cell, right? It's going to produce an IPSP and inhibit the cell. Okay. So here's one class of nicotinic acetylcholine channels. And we see that it's a membrane that spans the membrane. It has five polypeptide subunits that come together and they just fold back and forth across the membrane. And so this is the part that is lipophilic, likes to be inserted into the membrane. These are the ends of the protein that are hydrophilic, so they like to stick out in the aqueous environment, in the extracellular space, or in the cytoplasm. And there are two receptor sites on this particular kind of channel. There's one here and one over here, and this site matches up exactly with the acetylcholine molecule, which is going to be the neurotransmitter. So when this protein binds to acetylcholine, it changes conformation from a closed channel to an open channel. And when this channel opens up, primarily sodium enters the cell. Some potassium leaks out, it's not totally specific, but mostly it's sodium that enters the cell when acetylcholine binds, or two acetylcholines binds in these two locations right here. And when the primary effect is sodium entering the cell, what's the electrical event that's happening to the cell? It depolarizes, right, which is excitatory because it goes closer to threshold, right, and that produces a graded potential, and that graded potential then moves over the dendrite or cell body or from wherever this synapse is to the axon hillock, and if the graded potential is at threshold by the time it reaches the axon hillock, then the axon will produce an action potential that moves down to the axon terminus. Okay, so without binding neurotransmitter, this nicotinic channel is closed. Sodium cannot enter the cell. It just remains at RMP. But when 2-acetylcholine binds to a nicotinic channel, it always produces a positive graded potential or something that we call what? An EPSP, an excitatory postsynaptic potential. All right, the other kinds of ligand-gated channels that are specific to acetylcholine have to do with G-protein coupled channels. All right, so the neurotransmitter receptor is not part of the ion channel, all right, but it is a receptor site that's on the extracellular side of the membrane, and it's just a one subunit membrane polypeptide, so it can't really form a channel. It just has a receptor site. But when the neurotransmitter binds to this membrane polypeptide, it can activate an ion channel indirectly with these G proteins. And you kind of looked at a G protein already, so you might be familiar with what a G protein looks like. Remember, it needs guanosine triphosphate to become activated. So let's take a look. Here's a picture that shows the nice phospholipid bilayer, right, a plasma membrane. Here's the extracellular side of the membrane. Here's the intracellular side, both aqueous solutions on either side. Here's acetylcholine that dissolves in water very nicely, but that also means then that it can't move across the membrane. Right, to open or close an ion channel, acetylcholine still has to bind to a receptor site on the extracellular side of the membrane. And when it does, right, here's the receptor, it activates this G protein. And the G protein dissociates from the receptor, and also these three subunits dissociate into an alpha and also into a beta gamma particle. This beta gamma particle can diffuse around within the lipid part of the membrane, and it's moving around within the membrane. It can bump into another protein that is a channel. And in this particular case, it's going to be a potassium channel. Right? And when the beta gamma unit bumps into this potassium channel, it's going to cause the conformation change from closed to open. So now potassium can actually leave the cell. So what's going to happen to the membrane potential when potassium leaves the cell? It's going to be hyperpolarized. So in this particular case, acetylcholine is going to cause hyperpolarization, or an IPSP. It will inhibit the cell. All right, so acetylcholine sometimes can be excitatory, sometimes can be inhibitory. All depends on the particular receptor that becomes activated when acetylcholine binds to it. The other possibility is that this beta-gamma subunit can bind to a potassium channel that is normally open, right? And if it's normally open and the beta-gamma subunit binds to it, it's going to cause closing of this potassium channel. What happens then? This is kind of a little bit of a mind teaser, right? But if we open up a potassium channel, you just said it causes hyperpolarization or inhibition, all right? But let's think of the opposite condition. If it's a potassium channel that's normally open, what is it normally producing? Hyperpolarization when it's not stimulated, but when it's stimulated by the beta gamma unit and it closes, instead of producing hyperpolarization, what's going to happen? Depolarization. So if the potassium channel closes, it will actually depolarize the cell. And what kind of postsynaptic potential will be produced if this normally open potassium channel closes? Okay, it's going to produce an excitation or depolarization, which is what? An EPSP, an excitatory postsynaptic potential. All right, so these G proteins have a lot of variability, which means that it has a lot of control over various kinds of organs. All right, for synaptic transmission, once we activate a synapse, we don't want the activity of the neurotransmitter, in particular acetylcholine, to exert its effects for a long period of time. We want a short duration for control of these receptor sites over here so that another action potential can change the activity of the postsynaptic cell. All right, we don't want to excite or inhibit the postsynaptic cell forever as a result of neurotransmitter being released from the presynaptic cell. So there is an enzyme that breaks down acetylcholine within the synapse so that the postsynaptic cell can be excited or inhibited again. And that enzyme that breaks it down, which I see as this little Y formation right here, is called acetylcholinesterase. So acetylcholinesterase will break down acetylcholine into acetate and choline. And what can you tell me about acetate? You're kind of familiar with it because what is it? What can it be used for? When it's combined with coenzyme A, then that acetate group can be given to the Krebs cycle to generate ATP, right? So that's a pretty important metabolite that's not wasted. So acetate then is taken back up by the presynaptic axon. Maybe it can be recombined with choline to make neurotransmitter again, or maybe it's completely metabolized to make ATP. So the presynaptic neuron can do a lot with this acetate molecule that is produced by acetylcholinesterase. All right, let's look at some other neurotransmitters. Oh, we're not done talking about acetylcholine yet. We're going to look at a couple different locations. Acetylcholine, when it is a neurotransmitter, we call the neurons that use it cholinergic. All right, so a cholinergic neuron is a neuron that will secrete acetylcholine into a synapse to either inhibit or excite a postsynaptic cell. All right, in the peripheral nervous system, that's what PNS stands for, where it's used, okay, is in the neuromuscular junction. And neuromuscular junctions are huge synapses. So that every time an action potential coming down a somatic motor neuron reaches a somatic neuron terminus, it releases so much acetylcholine, it's always going to produce an action potential in a skeletal muscle fiber, which is then going to cause that skeletal muscle fiber to contract. And we're going to talk about skeletal muscle fibers pretty soon, maybe in about two or three chapters coming up, 2 or 3 weeks. All right, so that's what we mean by they always produce large EPSPs. And we call these end plate potentials that will always result in an action potential in a skeletal muscle cell. And skeletal muscle cells have no other kind of receptor. So skeletal muscles can never be inhibited. They can only be excited, which then will cause contraction. And that's why they're under voluntary control. When you send a signal from your brain down a motor neuron to a skeletal muscle fiber, right, it can never make up its mind whether or not it wants to contract. It's just always going to obey that command because the end plate potential is so huge. Right, it always reaches threshold by the time that graded potential reaches a voltage-gated channel someplace. All right, but that doesn't mean that skeletal muscle sometimes can't be inhibited by exogenous agents. That means an agent from outside your body. There's a compound called curare, and it can bind to the receptor site for that nicotinic receptor in skeletal muscle, and then it can block the action of acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction. All right, so if acetylcholine can't bind to the receptor because curare is in the way, then that's going to inhibit that neuromuscular junction, and that's going to then prevent that skeletal muscle from contracting. So there are many Aboriginal peoples in South America that knew of that trick. They're able to harvest curare, and they would coat the darts and arrows that they use for hunting with curare and inject some curare into a large game animal, and the large game animal then wouldn't have voluntary control over their skeletal muscles, and actually they couldn't breathe either, so that would cause the death of the animal, and then there could be a party afterwards, a big feast, right? All right, so people have used receptors, okay, and blocking receptors for eons, but they didn't really know exactly what was going on. But that still is kind of a basic building block of medicine today, and that is we'd like to create drugs that interact with our cells through binding to receptors or helping build receptors in tissues that are deficient in receptors or maybe blocking certain kinds of receptors in the body. And we're going to look at a number of pharmaceutical agents that do all of those things through the remainder of the class. Okay, another kind of neurotransmitter is a monoamine neurotransmitter. Here are three examples of monoamine neurotransmitters. Serotonin is one, norepinephrine, and dopamine is another one. And serotonin is derived from tryptophan. We didn't spend a whole lot of time looking at these classes of compounds, but does anybody know what tryptophan is? Maybe you have heard of it. It is an amino acid. Okay, what good are amino acids? What can you make with amino acids? Proteins. In this particular case, this particular amino acid can be used to make a neurotransmitter for synaptic transmission. The interesting thing about tryptophan, as well as tyrosine right here, they're called essential amino acids, which means if there's an essential nutrient, what does that mean for you? It means that you can't build it with the biochemistry and metabolism that you have inside your body, but you need it for normal health. So if you can't build that essential nutrient, where do you get it from? From your diet. You actually have to consume this particular amino acid. So tryptophan is one of those amino acids that you have to have in your diet in order to make serotonin, which is an important neurotransmitter in your body. And remember, the only place where you can get all the essential amino acids in a diet is when you eat animal proteins, right? So this is an amino acid that's deficient in some plants when you eat them, or plant proteins. All right. Same thing for tyrosine. Tyrosine is an essential amino acid. The only place where you can find it is in when you eat an animal protein. You don't get it when you just eat plant proteins. All right, but if you eat a variety of plants, like when you mix rice and beans together, you can get all of these essential amino acids. All right, so it's important if somebody is a vegetarian to know something about the diet and how to combine plant foods together so that you get all of the components of the essential amino acids that you need. Because what happens if you don't have tryptophan in your diet? You can't make serotonin, okay? And if you don't have tyrosine in your diet, you can't make norepinephrine. And these neurotransmitters are related to or can cause various kinds of pathological conditions. One example would be clinical depression, right? So affective disorders or even mental diseases can be produced by what? Inadequate diet. That's the take-home message that I was trying to get to, okay? So something that can be really intractable and hard to treat, like for instance clinical depression, right, could be just the result of somebody's diet, right? So that's really important to understand that. Okay, these compounds right here are what we call catecholamines. Serotonin, epinephrine, dopamine are catecholamines. All right, so let's look at a synapse that uses, for instance, maybe norepinephrine, which is a catecholamine. You have the neurotransmitter stored in vesicles, in the synaptic vesicles. So there's norepinephrine in these vesicles. When an action potential comes down, it opens up voltage-gated calcium channels. Calcium enters the cell because calcium is high outside the cell. That's going to cause these vesicles to move to the presynaptic membrane, fuse to the presynaptic membrane, release neurotransmitter, which is norepinephrine in this particular case, into the synaptic cleft. That's going to move by diffusion to the postsynaptic membrane where it binds to a receptor. And what can you tell me about this receptor right here? Does it look like a ligand-gated channel, or does it look like a G-protein-coupled receptor? Okay. Because there's no channel right here, that looks like a G-protein-coupled receptor to me. Okay. So when it binds to this receptor, it's going to activate a G-protein, which then can indirectly activate some ion channels. We'll take a look at that in just a little bit. All right, and just as in the case of acetylcholine, there should be an enzyme that deactivates norepinephrine. So how is norepinephrine's effect within the synapse regulated and decreased so that synaptic transmission can be regulated? Well, norepinephrine is not broken down usually within the synapse, but it's taken back up by the presynaptic cell. And once inside the presynaptic cell, then there's an enzyme that breaks it down, and that's called monoamine oxidase, or we can just call it MAO. Okay, in some kinds of pathologies like clinical depression, there is not a proper release of epinephrine at this particular synapse. Okay, it's reduced. So if we want to enhance the effect of norepinephrine in the synapse, right, there can be pharmaceutical agents that you can take to decrease the activity of monoamine oxidase, which will then increase the availability of norepinephrine in the presynaptic membrane so that when there is an action potential, then you get the proper amount of norepinephrine released into the synapse, right? And that kind of reduces the symptoms of clinical depression because now you have this synapse working properly. Okay, but what else do you need in your body in order to make norepinephrine? You can for instance, decrease monoamine oxidase, but what else do you need in your diet in order to make norepinephrine in the first place? You need tyrosine as well. All right, so there are a couple different ways to approach treating clinical depression. All right, there's another way too, and that is once norepinephrine is secreted into the synapse, you can block reuptake. Because when norepinephrine goes into the cell, it has to leave the synapse. When it leaves the synapse, it can't bind to the receptor. So one way to make more norepinephrine available to bind to receptors are here is to block the reuptake of norepinephrine. Right? And so there are reuptake blockers, which again can be used as antidepressants. and that keeps norepinephrine at a high concentration in the synapse whenever an action potential comes down from this axon. So these are excellent areas to understand how we like to treat different disease processes. All right, so here is a nice example drawn out really big of that G protein coupled receptor for monoamine transmitters. Here is the receptor, here's the G protein, here's the binding site, here is norepinephrine. When it binds to the receptor, it activates the G protein, which then dissociates and diffuses around through the membrane. And the alpha unit can bump into an enzyme protein that's inside the membrane. And this enzyme is called adenylate cyclase. The job of adenylate cyclase is to take ATP and to break it down into cyclic AMP and pyrophosphate, which is a phosphate-phosphate molecule. But cyclic AMP is an important signaling compound, right, which can activate a protein kinase. So here you have a protein kinase. What's the job of a protein kinase? What does it do? It phosphorylates something. Protein kinase inside the cell can bump into this ion channel right here, phosphorylate it, and when it phosphorylates this channel, it can then cause the conformation change in this channel right here, right? And it can open or close channels when it becomes phosphorylated, right? Which then, when this channel opens, it can cause depolarization if sodium runs in the cell, or it can inhibit the cell if it's a potassium channel and potassium leaves. All right, so you're kind of familiar with those schemes, but here is something that we haven't talked about just yet. We talked about kinases, for instance. What's the opposite of a kinase? A phosphatase. Okay, excuse me. But let's analyze what's happening right here from some basic principles that we're aware of already. Adenylate cyclase, right, you should know that it converts ATP into cyclic AMP, right, and cyclic AMP is a second messenger inside the cell. It's going to change the physiology of this cell because it can change the membrane potential through this membrane protein right here. What's the first messenger in this scheme? The first messenger is norepinephrine. It binds to the G protein, makes these changes in the membrane, so that cyclic AMP builds up inside the cell. So the second messenger is cyclic AMP, is the second messenger. Where do we always find the first messenger? Outside the cell. Okay, it's trapped outside the cell, can't get through the cell membrane. And where do we always find the second messenger? Inside the cell. Okay, and that's because this adenylate cyclase enzyme was activated by this G protein right here. All right, so what happens? What can you tell me about an enzyme when it catalyzes a reaction, when it catalyzes the reaction of one ATP into one cyclic AMP? What happens to adenylate cyclase? Does it change? No, it can catalyze the reaction over again. Okay, so what do you see on this scheme right here? You see one norepinephrine molecule making maybe thousands or tens of thousands of second messengers inside the cell. What do you call it on your radio when you take a little small signal and make a big signal out of it to make the loudspeakers sound really loud? It used to be a dial. You used to turn a dial. Now you just push a button. Right? That was an amplifier. Right? So here is one step of amplification because this adenylate cyclase doesn't become deactivated right away. You got a tiny, tiny little signal outside the cell that becomes a huge signal for changing physiology inside the cell. So here is one step of amplification, right? Making a big signal from the second messenger inside the cell. All right, but what does cyclic AMP do? It activates another enzyme. What happens to this protein kinase once it activates this one channel right here? Does it become inactive? What can you tell me about an enzyme during a reaction? Does it become inactivated just because it catalyzes a reaction? No. So it runs around, phosphorylates many ion channels right here, which produces a huge effect inside the cell. So when you have a series of enzymatic reactions, right, and each one of those steps is an amplification step, so the first step amplifies because you have thousands of molecules of cyclic AMP. Each one of those will create an active protein kinase, which can then phosphorylate thousands of ion channels. That's another step of amplification. We call that a cascade mechanism. So cascade mechanisms are real important for taking a really small signal that's outside the cell and making it an incredibly huge signal inside the cell, because it has a number of steps of enzymatic reactions. That's a cascade mechanism. All right, so you see amplification as well as cascade on this slide. So that's a good thing to know. You know what? This might be an exam figure. Is this an exam figure? Nobody knows? Ah, I hope somebody knows. Okay. Okay, ask me again. Oh, a cascade mechanism? Okay, one step of amplification relies on an enzyme to take a small signal and make it into a big signal, right? So one norepinephrine can produce thousands or tens of thousands of second messenger inside the cell. That's just one step of amplification. That's not a cascade. A cascade means that you have a couple enzymes working together. All right, so the first enzyme, adenylate cyclase, makes, let's just say, 1,000 cyclic AMPs. And then the second enzyme, this protein kinase, then, okay, you're going to have thousands of protein kinases from this one epinephrine signal, can run around, and each one of those can phosphorylate 1,000 ion channels. All right, so you have two steps of amplification. When you have multiple steps of amplification, we call that a cascade mechanism, which means the physiology of the cell can change very rapidly, even though you only have one signaling molecule binding to one receptor, because you have a number of steps of amplification, because you have a series of enzymes that become activated. So that's what we mean by cascade. Okay, let's look at another neurotransmitter. Maybe see me after class if I didn't answer your question. You might have to think about that for a while. Okay? Then you can ask me another question. Okay. Serotonin is involved in regulating mood, behavior, appetite, and circulation inside the brain. LSD is structurally similar, so it's going to bind to serotonin receptors. And that's going to produce the perception, change your perceptions of reality. It will produce hallucinations when it inappropriately binds to serotonin receptors. And serotonin receptors, or serotonin pathways, all right, we said are involved with mood and behavior. For instance, if somebody is depressed, that might be due to improper activation of a serotonin nervous pathway in somebody's brain, so that if we increase the activity of serotonin at the synapse, that might improve somebody's mood. And so there are serotonin-specific reuptake inhibitors, right, that can be used as antidepressants. That's a really good way to treat depression, because when serotonin is released from a synapse, it's not broken down within the synaptic cleft. It's not removed from the synaptic cleft immediately, so that potentiates or enhances the effect of serotonin as a neurotransmitter. And here are some pharmaceutical agents like Paxil and Zoloft, Prozac, that block reuptake of serotonin and prolongs the action of serotonin in serotonergic pathways within the brain. Dopamine. There are two main systems of dopamine in the brain, and I think I just want to talk about one of them. Actually, they're both kind of interesting. I guess I got time maybe to talk about both of them. One has to do with the nigrostriatal system, and that is involved with motor control. Okay, and degeneration of this system causes Parkinson's disease. All right, so what do you know about the motor control of your body? Like if I want have really nice control of my fingertip, like to point right to the tip of my nose, what do I have to do? I have to excite the biceps brachii, but at the same time, what about the triceps brachii? It should be inhibited, right? Because if the triceps stays contracted, and even if I contract the biceps, then I won't be able to move my hand, right? So the triceps has to extend, it has to relax, right? And this system right here causes relaxation of antagonistic muscles so that, for instance, the flexors can move part of your body. If antagonistic muscles aren't relaxed when you cause flexion of the biceps. If the triceps isn't relaxed, then your motion is very jerky and it's hard to move. All right, and that's what Parkinson's disease looks like. When somebody tries to move with Parkinson's disease, they don't have very good control. Their motion is very jagged, right, and staccatoed because they can't get antagonistic muscles to relax because the dopaminergic system isn't functioning to cause relaxation of some muscles. Okay, and you might know some celebrities that have Parkinson's disease. Do you know anybody that has Parkinson's disease that are very famous? Okay, Michael J. Fox is one. Muhammad Ali is another one. It's easy to understand why Muhammad Ali got Parkinson's disease, because he was a boxer and he had his head pounded by these other incredibly powerful, strong men, which then caused damage to the neurons of this system. And he has a hard time using skeletal muscles in his body, so his speech is slurred, his gait is very unsteady, and when you look at him, he looks like he's intoxicated with alcohol, but he's not. It's just that this particular system is not working properly. He has Parkinson's disease. Okay, Michael J. Fox, a little bit different. Okay, was never a boxer, never experienced any kind of brain trauma. Okay, and the common kind of description of early onset Parkinson's disease that the kind that Michael J. Fox, okay, maybe, you know, Michael Jackson never had any problems moving, so he never suffered from Parkinson's disease, but Michael J. Fox, okay, is usually a result of drug abuse, okay, that's the common understanding when somebody comes down with early onset Parkinson's disease, and when people would take designer drugs, it would bind to receptors in the substantia nigra, which would then irreversibly poison them. All right, so that people would lose control of their body as a result. But everybody has asked Michael J. Fox on numerous occasions, did you ever experiment with drugs or abuse drugs? And he said, no, never. And so now people are beginning to think that maybe, because he was a child actor, and a lot of times child actors are given amphetamines and other kinds of cocktails before they start a filming session, that he was slipped a drink. And some of those drinks that he was given while filming for the TV series that he was on actually destroyed part of his brain that is producing Parkinson's disease. And there are a number of actors on that set that came down with this kind of atypical Parkinson's disease as well, besides Michael J. Fox. But it can't be traced to any particular individual as a result. Question?
That's what I don't understand.
I read an article. Yeah. So it's just somebody just slipped them a drink, probably some kind of amphetamine or a designer drug to get him boosted up for performance, and yeah, he's dealing with that for the rest of his life. All right, so this involves the motor system. The second one here, the mesolimbic dopaminergic system, is involved with, again, behavior and emotional reward. And so this is the system that addicts like to activate with amphetamine-type drugs. Right, produces overactivity, and when these receptors stop functioning properly, that produces schizophrenia. And so that's the biological basis of treating schizophrenia, is with drugs that work with the dopamine neurotransmitter. Right, that's a different kind of mental disorder. All right, norepinephrine. Let's talk some more about norepinephrine. It's used in the peripheral nervous system and central nervous system. In the peripheral nervous system, it's used as a sympathetic neurotransmitter, all right? Sympathetic as opposed to what? Parasympathetic, right? So if we're going to think of two neurotransmitters for each of those systems, parasympathetic is more related to the acetylcholine, and sympathetic is related to norepinephrine. And what kind of neurons use acetylcholine? I mentioned that today. So unless you study this ahead of time, okay, they're called, the neurons that use acetylcholine are called cholinergic neurons. That's probably important to know. And the kinds of neurons that use norepinephrine are not cholinergic. We call these adrenergic neurons. Okay, and amphetamines stimulate these norepinephrine pathways, because in the central nervous system, norepinephrine is used for maintaining consciousness, or what we call arousal, all right? Maintaining a wakeful state. in the body. There are some amino acid neurotransmitters, and we're going to be talking about these throughout the remainder of the class. Most of these anyway. Glutamic acid and aspartic acid, these are amino acids. They're important central nervous system excitatory neurotransmitters. So when glutamate or aspartate bind to a receptor, what happens if they're excitatory? They open up a sodium channel somehow, which causes depolarization. All right, glycine is an important inhibitory neurotransmitter, and it opens up a chloride channel. So chloride enters the cell, that causes hyperpolarization, and that inhibits the cell. All right, now why do you want to have inhibitory pathways in your brain? Because you would never think of driving your car with just a gas pedal and not a brake pedal, right? In order to have precise control and balance over your body, including your nervous system, you need to have excitatory components and inhibitory components in order to have precise control. And another important amino acid is gamma-aminobutyrate, or butyric acid. This is the most common neurotransmitter in the brain, and it's inhibitory. All right, so I really want to kind of change your opinion about having inhibitory pathways inside your body. Degeneration of this pathway right here that uses GABA is what produces Huntington's disease, which is another motor problem that people can have. Okay, let's see how some of these neurotransmitters, okay, can operate within a neuron. And let's first consider excitatory postsynaptic potentials. All right, so EPSPs are, on what part of a neuron are they produced? The cell body and dendrites, okay, because the cell body and dendrites have special kinds of membrane proteins. What do we call these membrane proteins that can produce a graded potential? They're called ligand-gated channels, right? So dendrites and cell bodies that we see right here, might just want to draw this in, have ligand-gated channels, which when a ligand binds to receptor of that particular channel can produce EPSPs or depolarizations. We can see some depolarizations right here. Graded potentials have no threshold. As soon as an ion channel is open, then that's going to change the membrane potential from resting to whatever it's going to go to. EPSPs always cause depolarization, which brings the membrane potential closer to threshold. So that's why we call these excitatory. And they can sum together. So if we increase the relative amounts of neurotransmitter, graded potentials will be higher and higher and higher. Right? And then if there's a sufficient stimulus or sufficient neurotransmitter binding to ligand-gated channels, then there's going to be a large graded potential by the time it reaches the axon hillock, which will then cause an action potential at the axon hillock. And graded potentials will move in all directions through a dendrite in the cell body from the site that it's produced, right? Because there is no refractory period, right? So once a cell is excited with an EPSP, it can be re-excited once again, and these EPSPs can travel in all different directions. But the only one that really matters is toward the axon hillock, because that's where we have the trigger zone, because that's where you first have voltage-gated channels that have a threshold voltage. Okay, that's an EPSP. So let's look at a network, a really nice small neural network right here, that has two presynaptic neurons and one postsynaptic neuron. So this postsynaptic neuron is going to be getting information from maybe different regions of the body via these two different neurons right here. And let's take a look at this slide. What do we got right here? Ah, okay. In this case, neuron number one and neuron number two are going to release a neurotransmitter that will cause an EPSP in both cases. So both of these are excitatory neurons. And let's look at two different cases. The first case is when an action potential from neuron number one releases neurotransmitter. It's going to produce an EPSP on the postsynaptic neuron, and that graded potential is going to move over the dendrite and cell body down to the trigger zone in the axon hillock, and here I see the magnitude of the excitatory postsynaptic potential right here. What can you tell me about an action potential being initiated in the postsynaptic neuron as a result of this particular EPSP? It is? Is it at threshold or is it subthreshold? It's subthreshold, so the postsynaptic neuron right here, neuron, I don't want to say number two, let's just call it the postsynaptic neuron, won't start an action potential. So it's going to block the signal. It's going to make up its mind not to transmit information from neuron number one down to other distal parts of this neuronal circuit. Okay, because it deems that this information is not sufficient to pass on within the nervous system because it is subthreshold. Oh my God. Okay. But let's just say now that here we have a neuron and it's getting information, maybe two different kinds of information or information from different parts of the body, and each one is going to be subthreshold, but because graded potentials can summate, they can add together, the EPSP from neuron number one will add to the EPSP from neuron number two, and now it reaches threshold, so the postsynaptic cell will initiate and transmit an action potential, which will then stimulate other distal segments of this particular neural pathway as a result. All right, so it's really important that graded potentials can summate so that this postsynaptic neuron can decide whether to transmit that information on or not, or just to hold it. All right, and it can be the same kind of information from different locations in the body or maybe different kinds of information. All right, so for instance, one way that I maybe would think of this is, let's think of a fire alarm in the building right here. And maybe the dean is going to walk in and say, hey, we're going to test the fire alarm. So even though you hear the fire alarms, it doesn't mean we have to evacuate the building. All right, so then a minute later, we hear a fire alarm, and what are we going to do? These neurons integrate that information up and says, oh, fire alarm, you should actually leave the building, but what else is happening? We got information that says, well, we can ignore the fire alarm under these circumstances, right? So we're going to stay in our seats and continue with lecture. But now what happens if we get not only we can hear the fire alarm, so this neuron number one is firing, but then we also see the strobe flashing. So we can hear the fire alarm. Neuron number two is telling our brain, I see the strobe flashing. Okay, and it adds that information up, and it's also going to combine with information that we got from the dean that says, oh, we're just testing the fire alarm. What are you going to do? If you hear and see the fire alarm going off, and you've also heard the dean telling us, oh, you don't have to leave because we're just testing, what are you going to do? You're going to say, hey, press on with lecture. We got to get through this material, right? Okay, now let's just say there's another neuron right here. You see the flashing light of the fire alarm. You hear the fire alarm going off. You got information from the dean saying we're just testing the fire alarm. But now you also smell smoke. Another neuron is stimulating this neuron right here. It's integrating all of that information. So if you see smoke and maybe you also see not just a flash of the strobe, but you see some flames, what are you going to do? Well, you're going to ignore the dean, right? And you're going to say, hey, we're not just testing the fire alarm, right? So these neurons can take all this information, add it all up together to make some kind of appropriate response by sending action potentials down this axon from the trigger zone right here. So these neurons, an individual neuron is really sophisticated in terms of adding information together and making decisions on what to do for us. All right, so this is spatial summation when you have graded potentials from different regions of the body stimulating different regions, different dendrites or different regions of the cell body. Or there's something called temporal summation occurs because EPSPs from a single neuron, maybe just from this neuron number one right here, will produce graded potentials together in time that will summate because these graded potentials last for a fairly long period of time. All right, so that's what we would just call temporal summation. All right, so if a second graded potential gets started before the first one disappears or fades away, then they can add together at the axon hillock to produce an action potential. All right, let me see how many slides I got left. Maybe two slides left? All right. All right, so let's talk about synaptic inhibition. Postsynaptic inhibition. And here we see two presynaptic neurons, one postsynaptic neuron. All right, and this first neuron right here is going to be releasing GABA, okay, or maybe glycine. And from the previous slides, we know that GABA and glycine are inhibitory neurotransmitters. So when those inhibitory neurotransmitters are released on the postsynaptic cell, what's going to be produced? An IPSP, maybe because a potassium channel opens, or maybe a chloride channel opens, so that's going to produce an IPSP. All right, and then here's the second presynaptic neuron, and it's going to release maybe acetylcholine on this neuron right here, which is going to cause an EPSP. Right, and what can you say about these graded potentials? Here's the IPSP, which causes hyperpolarization or inhibition of the cell. Here is the EPSP that's produced by neuron number 2 by releasing acetylcholine on the postsynaptic neuron. These graded potentials will summate, right? So that in this particular case, right, if we look at the EPSP, which follows this IPSP, does it reach threshold? It doesn't reach threshold. But if this same EPSP came before the IPSP, what would happen? It would have reached threshold. All right, so we call this synaptic inhibition when the presynaptic cell can release an inhibitory neurotransmitter on the postsynaptic cell. So this occurs when one neuron synapses onto an axon, right, or a bouton of another, inhibiting the release of neurotransmitter. Oh, that's the next slide. Okay, what this slide right here just shows postsynaptic inhibition because these graded potentials happen in the postsynaptic cell. So this slide represents postsynaptic inhibition. There can be presynaptic inhibition, which is this slide right here. All right, so here are a number of presynaptic neurons. Here's a postsynaptic neuron. And all the presynaptics kind of look red right here to me. But here is a neuron that's inhibitory. Here is a neuron that is inhibitory. But here is one excitatory axon. So these right here will be releasing some kind of inhibitory neurotransmitter like GABA or glycine. This excitatory one is going to be releasing, for instance, maybe acetylcholine, which is excitatory. So these inhibitories that go to the dendrite or the soma of the postsynaptic cell are going to be producing IPSPs or inhibit the cell, causing hyperpolarization within the postsynaptic cell. But here is a second inhibitory neuron. And where are its axon termini? On the postsynaptic cell, number one, but it also has a synapse on the excitatory neuron, the axon of the excitatory neuron. And in this particular case, this inhibitory neuron is going to cause an IPSP in this region of the axon. Right, so when an action potential comes down, okay, it's going to blend with this graded potential, which is inhibitory, an IPSP, on the axon, and it's going to prevent that action potential from moving across this junction right here. So an action potential can't reach the axon terminus of this excitatory neuron, so that will not produce an EPSP on the dendrite or the cell body. All right, and since this happens on the presynaptic cell, we call this presynaptic inhibition. If it happens on the postsynaptic cell, we call that postsynaptic inhibition. So we're just beginning to learn about some of these synapses. Okay, your anatomy book did talk about these different kinds of synapses in terms of anatomy. So for instance, this synapse right here that's on the body of a neuron, this is what we call an axosomatic synapse. Axosomatic because it's a synapse between an axon and the soma of a neuron. This synapse right here is called an axosomatic naming the axon of this presynaptic cell a axodendritic synapse, right, because it's on a dendrite. And this kind of synapse is fairly new in our understanding. This is what we call an axonic synapse, because it's a synapse that's on an axon. And this presynaptic cell is going to inhibit this excitatory neuron from transmitting action potentials to the postsynaptic cell right here. So we got axosomatic synapses, we got axodendritic synapses, and even axonic synapses. And in this particular case, if this neuron is inhibitory, we call this presynaptic inhibition, because it's going to inhibit the axon from even reaching the postsynaptic cell, okay, or the axon terminus. And so it can't produce any graded potential in the postsynaptic cell. All right, so just jot down over here, axoaxonic synapse. And it's inhibitory because this is an inhibitory neuron. All right, let me see if there's anything I want to say. All right, I got 5 minutes left. Okay, maybe to answer some questions, but what I'd really kind of like to go over is that drawing that's in your study guide. Okay, just to recapitulate some things. So let's go back to this picture. I don't have that diagram handy. All right, so let's use this one right here. Okay, do you know the one that I'm kind of talking about, the one that's hand-drawn? And the key is also given to you in the Chapter 7 study guide. All right, so what are the three main areas of a neuron? You've got dendrites, you've got cell body, and you got axon. Okay, and in most diagrams, you see that information flows from a dendrite into the cell body and then down the axon. Okay, why can't information flow from the tip of this axon back up into the cell body? We would call that retrograde. Why can't it not go retrograde? Because action potentials have a refractory period, right? Have a relative refractory and an absolute refractory period, so they can only move in the forward direction. All right, so that also says then, since we're dealing with action potentials in this part of the cell, the axon, okay, what allows an axon to actually produce an action potential? There's a membrane component that allows a membrane to produce an action potential. There's a special protein that we find only in the axon, an axon terminus right here. And those are the voltage-gated channels. So impulse conduction right here, you would label this axon, and you would say voltage-gated channels. And the physiology that a voltage-gated channel produces is an action potential. All right. Now, what kind of potentials do we have on dendrites and cell bodies? What kind of potentials do we have? We've got resting membrane potential. But we have IPSPs and EPSPs, which are graded potentials. I want to start with graded potentials first. You have graded potentials on dendrites and cell bodies because what's the membrane protein that we have in dendrites and cell bodies that we don't have in axons? That's right, we have ligand-gated channels, right? So we have special proteins that are listening for chemical signals from other cells that can produce graded potentials. And then you should know that there's two basic kinds of graded potentials. What are the two kinds? IPSPs and EPSPs. Right? IPSPs and EPSPs are produced by ligand-gated channels because ligand-gated channels can produce hyperpolarization or depolarization depending on what kind of channel is open. If it's a sodium channel, what kind of graded potential is produced if it's a sodium channel? An EPSP. And if it's a chloride channel, what kind of graded potential is created? Inhibitory, because chlorine is going to enter the cell, right? That's going to hyperpolarize the cell, because a chloride ion is an anion, right? All right, and don't forget, graded potentials can summate. What about action potentials? Can action potentials summate? No, because of refractory periods, once again. Okay, they can't summate. And graded potentials can summate, so IPSPs can cancel out EPSPs. And how does an EPSP propagate from a dendrite over the cell body? Is it the same on one end compared to the other? It propagates with what? We say it propagates with decrement. It dies away. Graded potentials die away. What about an action potential from the trigger zone right here or this axon hillock down to the axon terminus? How is an action potential propagated? Without decrement, right? The amplitude is the same at the beginning, the proximal end of the axon compared to the distal end of the axon. Okay, what kind of membrane protein ensures that an action potential travels without decrement? Voltage-gated channel, okay? And also, some people said something about a myelin sheath. That's a nice concept. Here is a myelin sheath. There aren't any voltage-gated channels in this region, but because it insulates the axon right here, it just allows for a graded potential that's produced by the action potential in this region right here to travel a long distance before it triggers another action potential. And graded potentials are really fast when they travel. So you have an action potential here, and that produces one here, and that produces one here, and that produces one here. But you don't really have action potentials underneath a Schwann cell in this particular case. How do I know this is a Schwann cell right here? Because it doesn't have other processes myelinating other neurons, right? What's the name of a cell that will myelinate multiple axons? That's an oligodendrocyte. Where do you find oligodendrocytes? In the central nervous system. What's another important difference between a Schwann cell and an oligodendrocyte? Especially in terms of regeneration of an axon. Schwann cells promote regeneration because they make a regeneration tube, but oligodendrocytes prevent regeneration because it forms a scar over the axon that has been cut. Okay, so it prevents regeneration. And I guess that's a good thing. The brain is developed that way so that your brain doesn't turn into one big, huge tumor. Okay, so control of growth. It's what? Always the balance between growth and destruction of tissue that maintains balance inside the cell. Think of an osteoclast and an osteoblast, right? That activity has to be balanced. So antagonism is very important. What else was on this cell right here? Integration. So here's the receiving end because it has ligand-gated channels. Here's the sending end because it has voltage-gated channels. I think that's pretty much everything that's on that diagram. Okay. All right. So no sign-in sheet today. So I will see you Thursday. You can come see me during office hours if you wish on Thursday before the test.